The Mark Stein Show. And now, here's Mark.
Hey! Welcome along. This is the Mark Stein Show. We are live at sea, heading towards beautiful Jamaica. And we have an audience comprised of cruisers on the Mark Stein Cruise from the United States and various of His Majesty's dominions, although I don't think we have anybody from Jamaica here, so we may Shanghai somebody when we're in port. We also have, for some reason, a rather large Panamanian delegation. Yeah. ladies from Panama, I'm not sure they're ethnically Panamanian. I think they're basically taking refuge from all the various other collapsing Western countries around us. But it is, while we are at sea in the Caribbean, it is supposedly a US election year. And I thought when we first scheduled this cruise that it would be in the wake of Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina heading towards Super Tuesday. And I thought people wouldn't want to come on the cruise because they'd be all agog following the twists and turns of the nominating process back in America. And in fact, it's the weirdest election. I've spent, I guess, maybe half my life in the US, and this is quite the weirdest election season ever. On the one hand, we have a guy who has managed to, I think he's up close to 80% of the primary vote now. Primary vote is entirely irrelevant because he's up to 80% in the polls because he had the brilliant idea to knock out all his opponents by getting indicted twice a week. No one's ever thought of that before. It's brilliant. Okay, he's down by like $2/3 billion in combined judgments against him here and there, but he is a shoo-in for the nomination. On the other side, the Democrats are running a guy who's dead. Because apparently that's no obstacle to running for... And I wouldn't mind betting that you don't even have... You're not even confined to the two terms thing if you're dead. So I fully expect the guy who'll be even deader in whatever it is, 2028, to be running for his third term or whatever it is by then. He was on stage somewhere or other a couple of nights ago. He was trying to read a quote from the president whose portrait was behind him. He couldn't remember the name of the president. It was, in fact, Abraham Lincoln. I know that. Well, I'm a foreigner, but I know that because, generally speaking, if the guy's got a stovepipe hat, just taking a shot in the dark, you're likely to get that one right. But this guy couldn't get that one right. He then started talking about Xi Jinping, whom he's known, as he put it, until he was on course to become the leader of Russia. And he did this story that's been debunked 70, 80 times about how he spent months in China with Xi Jinping, traveling 17,000 miles through China with Xi Jinping. He did no such thing. As you know, he's reminisced about, he had a meeting with François Mitterrand, I think it was a week ago, and Helmut Kohl just 2 weeks ago. He's... It's fantastic stuff. He's due to meet with Lord Palmerston, I think, next week, and Marie Antoinette the week after that. And nobody thinks it's odd. When you look in the media, nobody thinks it's odd that you have the dead husk of a moth-eaten sock puppet propped up against the podium, has no idea where he is, who he is, what he's talking about, and he's running for his second term, even though he hasn't actually had a first term yet. Because whoever is running the government of the United States, it isn't him. And this is also weird, also bizarre. I thought we'd talk a bit about it today. And we have someone who knows what it's like to be running for president in normal times because she did that. She's my favorite presidential candidate. She represented Minnesota in the United States Congress, and then she ran for president, and she's currently the dean of the Robertson School of Government at Regent University in Virginia, but never mind all that. I think of her as a dear and valued friend because during these last terrible weeks when I was walled up in the D.C. Superior Court, she very kindly came to court, sat there with us all day, and then came back to the hotel for the post-trial debriefing. And that week of cheerful Minnesotans, because it was not only her, but John Hinderacker from Powerline and his wife, Laurie. And I think of the Minnesota week as my favorite week of that awful trial. Will you please welcome my friend Michelle Buckman? Thank you, Michelle. Great to see you. As I said, it's this election year is weird, and I got sort of pretty, as people do in New Hampshire, because you're the first primary state, so you can't turn without bumping into terrible presidential candidates who are at 0.00002% in the poll, but have a huge entourage and insist on infesting your general store and the local inn and all the rest of it. And there was none of that now. It's basically I don't know what you make of it, but it's basic destruction of all the conventions must mean something good or bad, mustn't it?
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on. It's a privilege this afternoon to be here. And I was so happy that you opened the program with that because you said the quiet part out loud. And that's the fact that this election cycle is unlike any, I think, in any of our memories that we've ever seen. It feels, it has a sense of it that this is pre-programmed. This is pre-programmed and utterly fake. Even the, with all due respect, Nikki Haley campaign feels utterly fake at this point because it's only meant to be a doorstop to Donald Trump. There is nothing real about it. You get a sense of these huge kind of global outside interests that are seeing that this is not your election, plebs, who live in the United States. This is our election. And we're going to have it the way that we want. And it's not pretty. It's not fun. It's not happy. It's not the usual things that you get in an election. It's just, we've got this all figured out. It's pre-programmed. We're going to have our pre-baked outcome. And democracy is so passé. Yeah. And we're just going to have our way. But don't say it.
Right.
Don't say it. But we have our pre-programmed outcome. And while people are depressed and down and wondering, are we ever going to get the American way of life back? We're hoping, we want it. But it's almost like we're being told, don't even try, don't bother, it's done. And that's depressing.
Well, we have, you know, whatever it is, seven, eight, 9 months to go. So a lot of things can still happen. Just to take the least important bit of it out of the equation. What actually is the point of Nikki Haley and her campaign at this moment?
Well, I think even before Nikki Haley got in, I don't think, this is my sense. I don't think there was ever an idea of a real candidacy, what you call a legitimate candidacy, that she actually thought that she was going to be going toe-to-toe on the stage and that she was going to win the election. I don't... Who could have thought that? Donald Trump, I think, came storming out of the gate with overwhelming odds that he was the presumptive nominee. And so, you know, early candidates who were involved realized that and at a certain point graciously bowed out. This is so bizarre that it seems like the more hopeless Nikki Haley's campaign is, the more she's adamantly trying to convince everyone that she's going to go until the convention. I think the next thing will be she's going to go until November.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is no pulling back on her part.
Well, that's what's so weird. She lost South Carolina, which happens to be her own state.
In a humiliating, broad-based fashion that's never been done before. Trump, on every one of these primary victories, everyone's been historic, including South Carolina, her home state. No one's ever won by that much before. And especially when you have the current governor, the senators, the resident dog keeper. I mean, everyone in South Carolina has gone Trump. There is no Nikki Haley constituency. And she didn't have a national constituency, so why would you humiliate yourself on a national stage? The only thing I can think, and this is allegedly, because I don't want to get a defamation case, but I think allegedly there must be big money, and I wouldn't do this for less than $20 million. I don't know what's on the table, but it better be big to humiliate yourself.
Well,
like that.
I think after that humiliating result, in the next 24 hours, whoever's giving this money gave her another, whatever it was, $15 bazillion to keep. So somebody is funding her for some purpose.
Well, we know
why.
Who, for instance, in New Hampshire, it was Reid Hoffman, Democrat Reid Hoffman. And then we were just hearing about the Democrat fundraisers in Hollywood. She went out and picked up some big checks out of Hollywood for her. Nikki Haley, Hollywood, what is this for? But it's all Democrat money. Yeah. And at this point, her most recent endorsement, interestingly enough, was U.S. House Representative Clyburn, who's from South Carolina, who he came out a Democrat and endorsed Nikki Haley in the race because he said everyone should get behind Nikki Haley because she is the surest loser to Joe Biden. Now that's saying something. who would lose to Joe Biden? And Clyburn just told us Nikki Haley would lose to Joe Biden.
That's a hell of an endorsement.
That's a hell of an endorsement.
Okay, we've probably done more on Nikki Haley than she deserves. You said something about earlier, you know, Trump was the kind of presumptive nominee because he had a kind of incumbency. But actually, 2 years ago, if you go back to that, it didn't seem like it was going that way. The media has told us, and a lot of politicians have told us that January the 6th was worse than 9/11. It's worse than Pearl Harbor. It's worse than the War of 1812. Not if you're a Canadian, that was it. But it looked, and the whole thing then was, you know, Trump had so much baggage. Someone was going to come along and say, okay, we're doing something new and all the rest. And instead, he's managed, as you said, these are all record-setting margins of victory in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and it's basically because of what the Democrats have done to him.
Well, it is. Like you said, he's ingenious if he would take credit for it, that the indictments were his idea.
Yeah.
But it reminds me in the book of Esther in the Old Testament of Haman, who was trying to arrange to hurt a fellow named Mordecai, and Haman ended up being the one who was hung by a rope on his own petard that he intended for someone else. And it seems like that's what the Democrats are doing. They're hanging themselves by the mechanisms they're trying to use to destroy Donald Trump. And instead, they see Donald Trump as a old shack, a tinderbox full of dynamite, and they're throwing a match in. I kind of think that's what January 6th was. January 6th was intended all along to be a rebranding exercise. Because remember, Donald Trump won historically the most votes that any sitting president has ever won in the history of the United States. He elevated by millions of votes. That doesn't always happen. And so they had to destroy him as being a viable president or presidential candidate, future candidate, but he also had the most popular agenda that had been put forth in modern times. That's the Make America Great Again agenda. He was wildly popular. And so they wanted to destroy that, and they did it through January 6th. They blamed him for what whoever the instigators are. It may have been the FBI, it may have been the CIA, it may have been the DOJ, we don't know. It's all allegedly, we don't want to get defamed again here. So we don't know who did it, but it was meant to wrap it around Trump's neck. People didn't buy it.
Well, you know more about it, because you were actually in...
I was there.
You were there
And I was actually in the Capitol when it happened.
Yeah.
Not as one of the January 6ers, but I had been outside that morning all day. I'd actually been there a few days ahead of time. And it was actually the most fun party I've ever been to in my life. Everyone was happy. They were thrilled. They wanted to be there. They wanted to support the President of the United States. They wanted to be able to stand up for what they believed in. And so there were no rioting people. There were no people calling for anyone's head on a platter. They were very happy. And I have lifetime privileges as a former member of the United States Congress to go into the Capitol. So it was probably around, I don't know, 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I just decided I was going to go in. It was freezing to death, for one thing, outside. Absolutely cold. So I went through the tunnels. I was in. I'd gone to Kevin McCarthy's office. I wanted to get permission to go into the gallery to watch the events because I can do that. But it was COVID, and I had forgotten the rules, the COVID rules. So the COVID rules, you can only have 10 members in this giant, gargantuan place. You can only have 10 people. And so I said, okay, well, if I can't do that, can I just go into, there's a chapel right off of the main rotunda, if you've ever been in it. It's George Washington's chapel. So I said, could I go there? And so the chaplain took walked me down and allowed, it's right by Nancy Pelosi's office. So I had stopped in, and I warned the people at Nancy Pelosi's office that I'm going to be in there. And I was wearing mom clothes. I was just, you know, I didn't look like a member of Congress. I had mom clothes, which is what the J6ers look like. So I was in there, and then all of a sudden I was praying actually about the events of the day. Nothing bad had happened. And then I remembered I had been invited by Secretary of State Pompeo to go meet him that afternoon at 2 o'clock. And I thought, well, okay, I could stay here and be a part of this, or I could go see him. They'd only started, I think, Arizona. They were going through each state to count up the electors. And I thought, well, Arizona, this is going to go on all night. So I'll just go over and see Mike Pompeo. So I left. I walked through the rotunda. No one was there. I must have missed the people who entered just by a couple of minutes. And then I went downstairs, and I was coming out, and then I was down in the subway because I couldn't get out the door. The Capitol Police said to me, well, you can't go outside. Some Trump people just crashed, and they're trying to cut. They crashed windows. They're trying to come in. And I said, I don't think it's Trump people. Those are the happiest people in the world. That's like a family reunion out there. I don't believe it. So I thought that, you know, they were stretching, or they're making up lies about the people outside, which that's what happened. But they said, I said, how do I get out of here? They said, go down in the subway. So I went downstairs, and all of a sudden, this barrel of 40 Secret Service agents come rushing by me, and it's Nancy Pelosi in the middle. And I thought, I don't want to see her. So I smashed myself against the wall because I didn't want to see her. And they ran by her over to one of the House office buildings. And I thought, if she's going that way, I'm headed back to the Capitol. So I went back, took the elevator, went upstairs. And I thought, okay, then I just won't go see Secretary Pompeo. So I went up there, and I'm not kidding you. I got out of the on the elevator on the floor where the rotunda is, and I saw marksmen looking like they were on the streets of Afghanistan. They had helmets and battle gear and AK-47s, and I'm looking, and it looks like Afghanistan inside the Capitol. And so a marshal, a Capitol marshal, recognized who I was, and he said, Congresswoman Bachman, you need to come with me. I said, okay, yeah. I'll come with you. And so then he took me out, and we were the Capitol, the inside of your American Capitol, was under martial law for the next 7 hours. No member of Congress was allowed to leave. And remember, that's when Ashley Babbitt, an innocent civilian, got shot in the head.
Yep.
And she was shot exactly where every member of Congress has to walk through double doors to get into the House chamber to cast a vote. And remember, the important House business that had to occur that day was the certification of the election.
Right.
That's why they were there. Yeah. They had to certify the two Georgia U.S. senators that won office that morning, and the presidency, Joe Biden or Donald Trump. So they forced those congressmen, in the middle of how many people who were killed that day, killed by Capitol Police.
Yep.
Actually, not one person was killed by a Trump supporter. People were killed by Capitol Police.
But because you were there, you saw it as it was unfolding in real time. Even before it had ended, the Democrats and the media and half the Republican Party had their narrative that this was an assault on the citadel of democracy, as opposed to something that even at the time,
looked weird.
Yeah.
It felt weird, it looked weird, because what had happened to me is, again, the marshals found another member of Congress. I went back down to the subway where Speaker Pelosi had been, and they said to this member of Congress, could Congresswoman Bachman just wait in your office? So I went over to one of the House offices. That was the first day that all the new members of Congress were starting that day. So all the new young interns and office staff, all 22 years old, were there. And so I looked out of this member's window down on the lawns at what was happening. And they had the TV on, Fox News, and it was Dana Perino, Donna Brazile, and they were describing what was happening from their Fox studio.
Right.
They were describing what was happening on the lawn. I'm looking at it in real time, what's happening. What they're describing is happening, the weird narrative, the false narrative, and I can say that as someone who was there with eyewitness testimony. They were describing a completely different scenario than what I experienced and that what I was looking at. And I said to the staffers, this is your first lesson you have to learn here. What you hear on TV is not necessarily the truth. This didn't happen. But I will tell you, I was with members of Congress locked up in this building until they were told, you have to come over now and vote to certify Joe Biden. So all of the momentum, it was psychological. The momentum at the beginning of the day was to question these election results and to not certify. When the riot happened and when the people started getting killed, Ashley Babbitt, Roseanne Boylan, Brian Sicklack was killed. When these people started getting killed, now you have death. Now you actually have blood in the Capitol, in the chamber.
And the idea of that, surely, was to lend an heroic quality to Biden's presidency, because he's a guy who'd spent the last year sitting in his basement eating tapioca, and so it wasn't the most dramatic and thrilling presidential campaign, and yet suddenly he's the living embodiment of the resilience of American democracy in the face of all this terror that was...
Well, he was at least the remainder.
Yeah.
He was the remainder at that moment, because President Trump was still president. Until January 20th. Yeah. This was January 6th. He had to be removed and gotten out of the way. So this, immediately that day, to me what it said is, this was a high-level rebranding exercise.
Right.
To destroy Donald Trump, who was loved and favored by the American people, to destroy the Make America Great Again agenda, but it was also to destroy Trump supporters.
Yep.
Don't forget that. Because the Trump supporters at that point were being called insurrectionists and terrorists themselves. So Trump was the chief terrorist who was leading the insurrection, and anyone who went along with Trump, they were also considered terrorists. So I will tell you, it's unbelievable that sense, and it's psychological. It was all pro-Trump. We've got to look at the evidence. Not one piece of evidence, because the whole day was going to be spent going through 50 states and the evidence of potential election fraud. Not one state ever put one sheet of paper of evidence down, because now all of a sudden the TV coverage is massive numbers of troops and people being cleared out and blood and death and people shocked, and you actually have broken windows in the venerated U.S. Capitol. So it was mayhem. So we witnessed mayhem, and then we were told what to think.
Yep.
And so when I was finally released from the Capitol about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, I could leave, but the members were all told, now you go over to the chamber, and now we're going to start voting, and you have to certify Joe Biden. Again, at no time did any evidence come forward. And I listened psychologically. I was sitting in a room with about 6 to 8 Republican members. And they, one by one, came to the conclusion this was Donald Trump's fault.
Right.
That he did this. And I'm just blown away by their view, because they're sitting there watching Fox News.
Right.
And CNN and MSNBC, they were convinced by the end of the day this was Donald Trump's fault, and they went over, and to a person, not one person contested the results or said, why don't we take a pause here? This is a constitutional crisis. They certified Joe Biden, I think, around 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, because,
and it was over.
Because they'd basically been told, you know, you're going to have to do this to correct the... Well, we've seen this is now... You ran for president in 2012. And that was the last normal-ish election.
It was fairly real, I have to say. That's when Mitt Romney became the nominee for the Republican Party against Barack Obama. This was Barack Obama's second term.
Right.
And the only reason I wanted to run is because Obamacare had been passed.
Yeah.
And the one thing I knew from Western civilization, once a nation adopts socialized medicine, that nation is in for the ride of its life. And that's why I ran, because I opposed socialized medicine in the United States.
No, well, that was the last normal election. And then in 2016, we had this thing again, which ought to be extraordinary, where the U.S. intelligence community... It was basically using the Five Eyes, you know, the intelligence...
That's the intelligence services, pretty much in the English-speaking world, including New Zealand and Australia,
Britain, Canada,
America, Australia, and the UK.
So they get the Australian High Commissioner in London, my old friend Alexander Downer, to arrange to have a drink with Papadopoulos, the Trump staffer.
Yeah.
And they're interfering in the 2016 election.
Then
Intentionally. Then we have 2020, where, again, 57 or whatever it is, heads of the intelligence community...
Sign a letter
saying definitively that the Hunter Biden stuff... is Russian disinformation.
The laptop is fake, all of it's fake.
So the idea now is that after what they did in 2016 and after what they did in 2020, they're just going to let us have a regular old election in 2024. Is that the theory?
That's their theory.
Yeah.
That's their good thing we're smarter than that. and this time it almost they're so ham-handed now. Mm-hmm. The way they're trying to run these fake elections is that anyone, a 12-year-old, can see through what they're doing now. It's so ham-handed. So, like, I love your phraseology of the dead husk of a president, because that is what he is. No one believes. Now, when you look at the numbers of Democrats and independents and Republicans that don't believe the election results of 2020, they don't believe the election results before the election has even been held of 2024. And so they, at this point, though, I think the intelligence community, they don't care.
Mm.
They really don't care, because they know what their plans are for this election. They know what their plans are after the election. Mm. And so now democracy is irrelevant as far as they're concerned. They're just going to have it their way. And the presumption is that we are so dumb that we won't figure any of this out. And if we do figure it out, they own every lever of power, every lever of media, and they'll stomp us to the ground. Yep. So we're irrelevant to them at this point. That's why we shouldn't fear them. We shouldn't respect them. We shouldn't revere them. Mm. We should laugh at them. We should revile them. We should throw back at them all of their ham-handed lies and nonsense.
Yes.
And that's why I love Ann and Phelan. Ann and Phelan take text messages, they take transcripts, and they just fling it back in their faces, and we get to have fun to boot, so it's great.
I love the way they just take the actual words the people said. You don't have to interpret them, but we've been talking about on this cruise the way half the country is living in an entirely different reality. What's interesting is that people have figured out, you know, if they can stick Trump with a bill of $500 million for a so-called crime of which there are no victims, there's no monetary loss, there's no nothing, that they can do that to Joe Schmo at 37 Maple Street as well, and he'll be in the same situation. But what is going on psychologically on the Democrat side? Because the thing about the Democrats is they always wanted novelty, and so it was generally the youngest, prettiest, most glamorous. You know, which it's hard to imagine now because he looks like a cautionary tale out of The Sex Life of Dorian Gray. It's like Bill Clinton is this sort of wraith staggering about. But back in 1992, he was the coming man. He was young. He was glamorous. Same thing in 2008, Obama. He was young. He was glamorous. And yet suddenly, this guy staggering around, slack-jawed, you know, Trump. If you've ever seen Trump's brilliant impression of Joe Biden trying to get off the stage, Democrat voters must get that this is not the normal Democrat candidate.
Well, I think if you're talking about classic Democrat voters, that would be true. Mm. Classical Democrats, which we have great respect for. Mm. But I think a lot of some of the current Democrat voters, they're along for the ride because it's outcome-based elections.
Yeah.
We don't care how we get there. It's just the outcome that we want to have. And so there are a number of, I think, the coalition of constituency of all the identity groups. That's all they care, is what's the outcome. And so elections and democracy, it's really interesting. It's kind of a rear-view concept for the Democrat Party. Democracy, Democrat Party. But what it actually means is in the rear-view mirror. I thought this week there was a great example of that. That was in Politico, and maybe you saw it. It was a female writer in Politico who was actually denigrating Christians who were involved in the election process. And she was completely ignorant of the Declaration of Independence and of Thomas Jefferson's words that we are equal and that our rights come from God.
Yeah.
Anyone who believes that our rights come from God is a so-called Christian nationalist, and they certainly aren't an American. It was astonishingly, stunningly ignorant, and she was very bold in the media about it. It was incredible. But it's a completely different ideology, a different mindset, and it really is, it reflexively finds democracy repulsive.
Right.
Because democracy means that there may be an outcome that we don't agree with.
Right.
And so they don't trust the people anymore. They know what the outcome is. We're all irrelevant. They're going to shove it down our throats and pretend they'll buy crepe paper and balloons, and have us pretend that we actually won an election when they've already just given us a dog dish and said, eat it.
Well, we are in very strange times for self-government by free peoples around the world. And because the circumstances are different in each country, As we've talked about, we had this very weird result in 2020 where a guy who didn't campaign and a guy who just sat in the basement, and a guy who, when he did come out of the basement, basically he'd have these rallies where there'd be like seven cars parked in this vast empty space, and he'd be talking to like 37 staffers in the middle of nowhere, and yet he supposedly is the leader of the free world. In the UK, Rishi Sunak lost the leadership election. Liz Truss became prime minister. 2 days after she became prime minister, the Queen died. So she's prime minister during 3 weeks of royal mourning in which nothing's happening. And then the minute royal mourning ends, they get rid of her and install the guy who lost the leadership election. Nobody knows who put nobody knows who put that guy into power. France, Emmanuel Macron, this sort of bloodless technocrat who was dating his high school drama teacher since he was 12, he's the new force in French politics, and he becomes the leader. You know, we talk. You cover this in a way nobody else does, because most of your fellow Americans never ever go to any of these meetings, but you go to Geneva, you've gone to the World Health Organization meetings, and it does seem to me that there's this whole other world where the important people make the decisions, and then mere rinky-dink national elections are just a bit of dinner theater for the rubes.
It is, and it's a poor quality dinner theater as well. But you're right about that. It's interesting how, from our mind and our historic memory, we recall that we're a freeborn people who've been allowed to choose the leaders that govern us, and we choose them based upon issues and the issues and viewpoints that we hold. That's historically the West and how we've elected people. And now that has become irrelevant. I've seen it with my own eyes. Mm. And now it is fewer and fewer people who are calling the shots, down to almost, you could say, a handful or two of people who seem to be calling the shots. And I saw that when I went to the World Health Organization last year. I wanted to go because I couldn't believe the documents that had been issued. Mm. Because what the documents foretold is that should the 193 nations of the United Nations agree to this in Geneva, Switzerland, what they were effectively doing is surrendering national sovereignty of all 193 nations to the most recent example of rank unqualified governance during COVID. That's the World Health Organization. And so they would be yielding sovereignty over the most important issues that these nations would cover. Healthcare, yes, but healthcare also, the umbrella was so large, it included racism, poverty, income inequality, abortion, climate change. Yeah. Any issue you came up with, that issue would come under the purview of the World Health Organization. And in effect, with the proposed international health rule amendments and pandemic treaty synthesized together, what they were creating was a platform.
Yeah.
And that platform was for global governance. And contained within the documents is that a new form of government would be created called the Council of the Parties. And the Council of the Parties would be about five appointed people.
Yeah.
And so from there on out, there wouldn't be a need for any further amendments because they would decide what new changes had to be made. And I'm looking at this thinking, okay, 193 nations representing 8 billion people on Earth coming to Geneva, Switzerland for the purpose of surrendering independent national sovereignty to a group of failures who are going to then self-choose five appointees who will say, thank you very much, we'll take it from here.
Yeah.
And they're planning now, absent any objection, If there was no objection last May, and if there's no objection this May, then they'll just basically take a magic wand and say, it's approved, and now we'll take it from here. That's May of 2024.
Right, right.
So here, this is the end of February. Today is the 26th of February. And so it'll be then March, April, May. 3 months from today, they will be in Geneva, Switzerland, saying, thank you very much. We'll take the world from here. Now, you may think Michelle Bachmann is a madwoman. You may be correct. But this is on paper. This is not my language. This is their language. Yeah. And this is their proposal. So that's why when you look at the American election and say, this feels fairly pre-programmed, this feels fairly fake, I think it's by design, because there is an intention that the people won't have a say, that the brains above are going to take it from here into a fairly dystopian future that I don't think a lot of us would recommend.
Well, that's the, from their point of view, that's the great thing about global government. I don't know what polling booth you go to vote that down.
Well, you don't. Hmm. Once you yield national sovereignty is, contrary to popular belief, very difficult to obtain.
Yes.
But they think it's nothing to slough off sovereignty to them, and then they'll take it from here. That's the big stuff. What I love about you, Mark, is you deal with the big issues, the real issues. And this is as big as it gets from a governance perspective. As you had said, I'm the dean of a government school.
Right.
I've been a member of the United States Congress. I ran for president. That was kind of my background. Mm. And I am appalled to see what's happening and to see that there wasn't one member of the U.S. Congress that was in Geneva last year.
No.
I don't know how many are planning to go. I don't even know how many of the 535 members of the Senate and the House are planning to go this year. Mm. I hope they do. I hope that everyone's nation plans to send people who stand up, scream, shout, throw a tantrum and say, not us, we're not gonna go along with this, because unless we object, this will be done.
Yes.
It's that important.
Yes, and it's slightly weird, as you say, because the World Health Organization was a big player during the COVID years, and the COVID years were a complete disaster.
Destroyed the global economy.
Yep, and they destroyed the global economy, destroyed a generation of children who are all developmentally damaged.
From anxiety, depression, strange weirdness.
Yep, and then again with this, so again, it seems that there are two things going on. There's the sort of horse race of politics, which isn't even a horse race really this time, because it's
predetermined outcomes, kind of like court cases now.
Let me just go there, because you had a day-long conference at Regent University about what happened in the election. Now, we have people here from Britain, Canada, Australia, other parts of the Commonwealth, where elections last 6 weeks and you vote on paper ballots and they count. And you know how the Canadians here know this. The polls close at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the evening. And unless it's a pretty tight nail biter, you know that they announce the results at 10 p.m. and everybody goes to bed. You have this unique system where in whatever congressional district that was in upstate New York, just south of the St. Lawrence, they didn't manage to definitively count the votes.
Ever. District 22.
District 22 in New York, where I think they came up with a result like 3.5 months after.
They just said, oh, to heck with it.
Yeah.
Let's just designate this one.
Because we're old-fashioned in Canada. Like, we hold Election Day on Election Day. And you now have this system where it's months beforehand and months afterwards.
Until you get the final result you wanted all along.
Yes, that's the point. Because the reason polls are open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. is because that means if you're some sort of scoundrel or rogue, you've only got 12 hours to steal the election. The minute you say it's 3 months beforehand and 3 months afterwards, anybody can steal the election. Why do people put up? I mean, it would seem it's nothing like anything. I'm not even talking about, you know, the Westminster system. It's nothing like they do in France or Scandinavia or anywhere.
Well, it's nothing like they've ever done in America.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen elections like this since 2020. That's the first time we saw it. And from my perspective, my assessment is 2020 was a coup. Yeah. The United States went through a coup, and we're in that coup right now. And it's taken out of the voters' hands our choice and put it in the hands of some elites. That's where we're at right now, I think, is that we're living through a coup, and so the people who are in charge want to prevent the people from having their say, because it's pretty clear from the polling data what the people want, and it's not what they're getting right now. They want something very different. And I think that every effort is being made to prevent that. And I think especially this election cycle, the words you began this segment with regarding the lawsuits and the lawfare, this is a novel political tool that we haven't seen much before in the United States, but now it is the main and the primary tool for winning this election.
Yep.
And it's the indictments, it's the accusations, it's both civil trials, it's criminal trials against the president, against his businesses, against his business associates, his associates, and they're continuing to file indictments until they finally bring him down. So whereas before we would go through primaries, we don't go through primaries.
No.
Now whether it's Georgia, Florida, D.C., New York, those are the primary states now because the elections are actually being held there. This Attorney General of New York, Letitia James, who actually ran campaign ads when she was running for office, I'm going to get Donald Trump.
Right.
This Fannie Willis, who's running for D.A. in Fulton County, Georgia, she actually ran campaign ads, I'm going to get Donald Trump. Alvin Bragg, who was running for DA in New York City, ran campaign ads, weirdly, all paid for by the self-same George Soros.
Right.
I'm going to get Donald Trump. How odd, in all of America, these are the people who are bringing these cases. And Letitia James, now she's holding daily press conferences. It's almost like the lotto winner, and she's the lotto winner. And it's like she's announcing the results of the lotto. So she has big signs with like a running meter on
how much
Trump owes today. Today, I think it was up to $464 million. She goes down to the final penny how much he owes, because the interest payments are going up.
Yeah, no.
And they prevented him from even paying the bill of this $500 million because he can't borrow from any bank that's headquartered in New York, which guess what? That's where all the banks are headquartered.
Right.
He's prevented from running his business. He can't even borrow money. He has to liquidate assets, and she's like those old cartoons where you have a wolf with the saliva coming off his teeth.
Yeah, yeah.
She's saying, "Yeah, I'm eyeing every day your building at 40 Wall Street. I'm gonna attach your assets if you don't bring up the cash." And I'm sure what they're gonna do with it, they're gonna attach it and fill it with migrants. So you can never use the building again.
Right.
I probably gave her an idea if she hadn't thought of it.
No, and you're right, she's got this running meter, like it's tri-state megabucks about what it's up to up to today. The thing about it, if you try to say, look at the poll numbers, and Trump is ahead beyond the margin of error now in most of the so-called swing states, if we're pretending what's going on is normal. So if that holds true on election day, then he will win and he will be the president-elect. Who is he going to have serve in his administration when everybody who's had anything to do with him the last 8 years has been, you know, Rudy Giuliani is
148
ruined.
Million.
Yeah.
Had to declare bankruptcy, sell everything.
And Peter Navarro's gone to jail.
4 to 5 months in jail.
Yeah. And then the lawyers, Jenna Ellis, who was his lawyer in Georgia, in the Georgia case, copped to, well, she was one of his co-defendants. Because that's the thing, if you agree to be Trump's lawyer, you'll be criminally indicted. So is there going to be a big lineup of people who think, oh, you know, I really would like to be attorney general in the next Trump administration. I mean, who's he going to get to take the job?
It would guarantee that only billionaires could serve in the administration because the only way Donald Trump is able to continue is because he did have a massive assets that he could draw from, and that's what it guarantees. But that's extremely important. But again, on the lawfare aspect and what you've had to put up with, what you've had to go through. You have all of the Trump officials, his lawyers, who've had to go through the lawfare. It is election interference. And think of how brilliant this is, because this doesn't cost the Democrats anything.
No.
There's no money. There's no fundraising that you have to do. You just get judges who donate to Biden for president. So the next thing you're going to hear about a month from now is a criminal case that Donald Trump will have to go to court for. He'll be in front of a judge who has donated to Biden for president, who has donated to kick the Republicans out, who has donated to a progressive a fundraising outfit, whose daughter worked on and ran the Kamala Harris for president campaign, who's now raising hundreds of millions to oust the, I mean, you can't make, and that's just one of them. They're all like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like Comey, who you saw the same like six people in the FBI who did everything.
Yeah, who just circled all around from one thing to another.
And now it's the same thing with these judges. The same judge who put Donald Trump's CFO in jail and gave him the maximum five. He's the same judge, because apparently they can't find any others, who's now going to try this case whose daughter ran Kamala Harris's. No one ever recuses themselves.
No.
No one has any shame. They just, because they know this is outcome-based electioneering. It's justice.
And outcome-based justice, too, which is absolutely...
And you understand that.
No, I understand that. Let me ask you then about the Supreme Court. You've had this thing where Colorado and Maine both decided that Trump is ineligible to be on the ballot. So again, we are in, you know...
Never before challenged territory.
Yeah.
Never before done.
And it's basically, that's the sort of thing, they've said the opposition, they've removed him from the ballot. Oh, that's great. Where is this? Is this Senegal? Is this Sudan? No, it's Maine and Colorado. And so it eventually gets before the Supreme Court. They're sitting on that thing now. You would have thought there would be an urgency about that, and they would have issued their ruling by now.
And that it would have been over and done and settled. I don't know if they're waiting for Hawaii to file a case. I don't know what they're waiting for, but this is obvious. This is completely unconstitutional. You can't have a Secretary of State throw someone off, or a local county electioneering individual do this to remove someone who's running for the presidency of the United States. Again, all of this is uncharted water. It's never happened. Clearly unconstitutional. But that's all we've seen throughout this election. One unconstitutional action after another, including these lawsuits that Donald Trump is going through. These are clear violations of the Eighth Amendment against excessive fines, against excessive punishments. It's interesting. It doesn't matter what the Declaration of Independence says. It doesn't matter what the Constitution says or the constitutional amendments. These people want what they want, and they're going to get it. So if we're seeing that in the United States, where we've been a semi-normal country for about 250 years, so much more so if the WHO becomes a platform for global governance, do you think they're going to recognize the basic rights of humanity or respect the United States constitutional rights? They will not, because they have an agenda, and they're going to live it out. That's the moment that we live in world history.
Yeah.
We've never lived through this moment in world history where it's gone to a global level before of a denial of Democrat rights that have been held since King John at Runnymede.
I think you're right. And people assume that, as you say, Magna Carta 800 and whatever years ago now, and then you have all these advances across, and people think it's like inventing the wheel, that once you've invented it, you can't uninvent it. But in fact, self-government is not a typical state of humanity, and it can be uninvented, and people are uninventing it right before our eyes.
We're going to lose it at your peril.
Yep. We're going to take some questions on, so if you're all excited because Asa Hutchinson is up 2 points in the polls. I don't even know whether the poor guy's still in the race, but it...
He dropped out, mercifully.
Thankfully, Michelle is following these fascinating twists and turns. I've always found the, you know, the cumbersome nature of U.S. electioneering. I remember getting an email when Trump started running, and I said, oh, he's looking pretty good. And Mike Murphy, who was advising Jeb Bush, said to me, you don't get it, Stein. He said, even were Trump to win New Hampshire, we've already bought up all the TV advertising in South Carolina, so he's got no way to capitalize on that, and so he won't be able to have any path forward. Jeb Bush, with Mike Murphy advising him, spent $100 million to get to 3% in Iowa. I could get 3% in Iowa, and I'm not even eligible to run. Let's take some of your questions. We have...
I think that Chris and Karen Hall actually captured it with your phrase of send money to sendmoneynow.com.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the Jeb Bush campaign.
I know. I love that. I love all those Republican... You know, if you like if you toyed with supporting Eisenhower in 1952, you're still waking up to 47 emails every morning saying send money now to sendmoneynow.com. Who knows what they do with it? I have no idea what they do with it.
They might as well buy big houses and BMWs in Arlington.
That's true. Let's take some questions.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm John Fuller from Congressional District 19 in Florida, where 4 years ago we had an open seat. We had five candidates running in the primary. Marianne and I decided to get involved. The winner of that primary won by just a couple hundred votes. And that person is Byron Donalds. We're so proud of him. And that's one thing I wanted to say. The other is a homework assignment for the audience. Next time you're online with your bank, go to their homepage. There's a tab, probably if it's like my bank, Fifth Third Bank, says who we are. And you follow the links down, and they're all into the DEI, ESG. And I became aware about a year ago that Larry Elder, the black face of white supremacy, Ben
the
Carson.
Black white supremacists are the worst. You should be particularly suspicious of them.
Just like Clarence Thomas, another white supremacist. Yeah.
Ben Carson, and I'm sorry, I'm not a country music fan enough to know there's a country music singer. They formed a bank in Oklahoma. Many of you will have heard of it. It's Old Glory Bank. We are in the process of moving our direct deposits over to that bank because they are anti-ESG and so forth. The last thing, the question for you, as I'd like to get your input, as I watch the parade of outcasts from Fox News, starting with Bill O'Reilly, Tucker Carlson, James Rosen, Greta Van Susteren, Eric Bolling, probably a couple more that I'm forgetting. Several of them seem to have ended up at Newsmax, and I just like your comments on Newsmax. As we look for some reversal in our domestic United States media, what you think of Newsmax or whoever else you're giving any kudos to?
Well, I usually go to steinonline.com, and I listen to the Mark Stein Show. I get the best commentary I've ever heard in my life, and I'm a lifelong Steiner.
Well, you know, that's very kind of Michelle. But the funny thing was there was a loss of faith in Fox News by conservatives on election night because of a call that their election division made. And the trouble that caused, you mentioned Newsmax. Newsmax actually beat Fox in a couple of time slots and because people had just abandoned
tuned it off.
Yeah,
they said that's it.
And I think it's important that, you know, Fox News is owned by Rupert Murdoch. And Rupert Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch is a brilliant man. He built a huge global empire from his base in Australia and then London and then with Fox News in America. But Rupert Murdoch, the idea that Rupert Murdoch's interests are aligned with yours generally is not the case. You know, it's foolish to think like, it's foolish to think like that. Rush, whom I miss terribly, Rush built the whole, he didn't have a Rupert Murdoch figure in his life. He basically built that whole thing by himself. And that's not true of the people who've come along since and who have succeeded them. In the end, and I had a similar experience recently in the UK. You think, oh, this is great. We've got some money from, there's some guys in the United Arab Emirates who want to sink a lot of money into a media venture. And it's kind of fun, you know, it can be fun and it's all, but to think that the guys in the venture capitalists in the United Arab Emirates have the same interests as, you know, Mr. and Mrs. America and are looking out for your interests. They've got other fish to fry. And when they're all jetting into Davos and they're meeting up and they're backslapping and they're, in the end, the global elite have more in common with each other than they do with anybody in the countries they fly over. And that's just, let's take another question here.
Mark over here.
Oh, we've got over here, yeah.
Professor Bachman, how much of Congress is scripted and choreographed, like professional wrestling? And does the election of Mike Johnson to Speaker of the House and Mitch McConnell's failure to pass border and Ukraine funding suggest that congressmen have more freedom of action than traditional political economy?
Well, it's fairly lowball dinner theater, which you see in the United States Congress, with all due respect, because there's really only one vote that a member of Congress or a member of the Senate take, and that's the first vote, and that's your vote for leader. And that's almost pre-baked before you even get there, because you're bullied and told that you have to vote for the Mitch McConnell or the John Boehner or whoever the person is who's going to be running for that slot. And then after that, then you've effectively given over your franchise to the leader. They make all the decisions. Mm. There's not even debate within all the Republicans in the Senate on what they should do on a bill, or in the House what they should do on a bill, or how it should be written. You know, it's all quaint ideas now, this idea of debate. And so all of your time is spent going out and telling people to send money to sendmoney.com. That really is it. That's how the game works. And so you become a professional fundraiser on a treadmill. And then you're told what to do, and for some reason people enjoy it. And I can't for the life of me understand it. One of the greatest things that happened, I think, was this recent speaker's race that happened. Because you had the vacating of the chair in the U.S. House, and Kevin McCarthy was no longer the Speaker of the House. And I was in bed watching this, and I asked myself, what would I have done if I would have been there? And I didn't know the details. I didn't know what was going on. And I thought, well, you know, just on its surface, you probably wouldn't do that because you don't want to take the chance that Democrats could take over the chamber. That could happen. Mm. All you have to have is the first 218 who can put a coalition together, and there's enough rhinos that could be bought off that actually that could happen. So I thought, I'm not sure I'd do it, but yet there's a truism. Nothing changes unless something changes.
Yeah.
And so I actually was happy that they had done that. But I know Mike Johnson. I had known him before I went to Congress. I knew him when I was in Congress. I knew him after I went to Congress. He is a very good man. And I believe that he was probably the exact right person for this moment. You know, the House has the smallest margin in the history of Congress right now. They have a two-vote margin. So someone's sick, they die, their kid's getting married, you know, you lose it. And you can't have a vote that day, or you set it out. And so he's really a trusted individual, but it's a very difficult situation. The goal is hold on to majority through November. They can't do anything wild and radical like the Democrats do when they get the gavel, because they operate with one voice. Because there are no independent thinkers in the Democrat caucus. It's this is what you're going to do, and they all do it. There are some, by contrast, there are some independent thinkers in the Republican caucus. They're not good acting as a unit for important things that need to happen. Because remember, Donald Trump was a Republican president. We had Mitch McConnell, a Republican Senate leader, and Paul Ryan, the House Republican leader. So the Republicans had it all.
Right.
So they could have gotten rid of Obamacare, slam dunk.
Yeah.
They could have built the wall, slam dunk. Yeah. They could have made America great again, slam dunk. And Paul Ryan chose not to. And Mitch McConnell chose not to. You'd have to ask them why. But they castrated Donald Trump for the first 2 years of his presidency.
Yep.
It wasn't his fault. The people who were elected with all the sendmoney.com to sendmoney.com ads on TV were fakes and frauds and liars. And they don't deserve to be there. They should give the money back.
Let's have, well said. Let's have another question from this side here.
No, thanks. My name is Mike Steckhan from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. I love saying that to Americans.
Yeah, no, I love
the puzzled expression is really, really
let's
entertaining.
Let's hear it for Saskatoon. I was telling you, I many years ago, I was briefly on a radio station in Swift Current. Anybody here from Swift Current, Saskatchewan? Great.
Only myself, Mark, originally. Nonetheless, I want to compliment you and thank you for the picture you have painted, especially Michelle, of the geopolitical picture we are living through today and have for a number of years now. I wonder, as I look into the future and as an ex-member of His Majesty's Navy, I do tend to think sometimes strategically, and I do tend to look into the crystal ball if I can. It occurs to me that the left, the institutional left of the world and of North America would not be doing this if they hadn't actually thought about the potential consequences. This is the elephant in the room I'm bringing up here that I don't think anybody wants to talk about but are all concerned about. The institutional left must have considered that this eventually could become kinetic.
Mm.
And if you know what I mean by that, kinetic, I'm talking of a round solution in 5.56 millimeter diameter. But nonetheless, have they not considered they could do this? They must have. They're not all entirely stupid. You know, they must have considered into their future what they're planning. This could get out of hand.
Well,
what's going to happen then? I mean, we could ask Ashley Babbitt.
Yeah.
But if that particular mentality continues on, where are we going to end up here? And how can we forestall that? Because as the next member of the Armed Forces, I don't want to go anywhere near there.
Yeah. What do you make of them?
The American people, I can only speak for what I've observed in the United States, are actually a very peace-loving people, for the most part happy, but a peaceful people. If you look at Black Lives Matter and Antifa, all of those riots came from the progressive left, and some of them may have had some institutional help, allegedly. They may have had some institutional help from some government entities. But that isn't the real people. It is amazing the level of restraint that the American people are showing, I think. And I sometimes share your question of whether or not there isn't, in fact, an effort to push Americans toward a kinetic response, a military-type response against those who are in power. I don't think that's the direction that the American people choose or want to go. They really do want to act at the ballot box. And I think what we have to do is at all times urge people to show restraint, that we don't go out into the streets and become violent, because once that happens, I guarantee you, if that happens, if you have a group of patriots who go out to the street, let's say, and wearing red, white, and blue like the fake Trump people on January 6th, supposed Trump people, then you have your basis for gun confiscation. And that's the one thing that keeps the left in check right now is the Second Amendment and the fact that there's a lot of hardware and a lot of ammo out there across the United States. And they fear that, and they would love to see Americans actually take guns, take up arms. And if that happened, then it would be a wholesale removal of guns from people and ammunition.
Yeah, you're saying that there's a segment that is trying to provoke people into acting violently.
It wouldn't surprise me.
But at the same time, you know, if you have an even more brazen electoral theft this time round, then you're actually teaching people that voting counts for nothing. Elections don't matter. And in that case, what is left but taking to the streets?
Well, that's right. And that's why I think we need to watch how this goes, because, again, I believe this is a pre-baked, fake, outcome-based election where they already know they're running naked to the finish line and they're going to get what they want to have and then create this platform for global governance and the nation state becomes irrelevant. So if that happens and people have the light bulb go off over their head and say, we've been had and we've been stolen, and if they would choose to go to the streets, I think, again, you could potentially see another January 6th where you have fake people in the streets resisting to give that prerequisite for overarching action against the people. It's ugly. It's extremely ugly, but that also doesn't take into account what we've seen happen, the ravages at the southern border and the northern border, where we've seen upwards of, some people say, 7, 8, 10, 12 million people illegally entering under Joe Biden's watch. Now, the CBS is issuing the numbers of Chinese who are coming through San Diego every day.
Right.
I mean, it's literally thousands of communist Chinese, Iranians who are coming in. So the big concern on people's heart, and people on the terrorist no-fly list.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's been about 1,000 people that they've interdicted who are on the terrorist list. This has never happened before in American history. They've interdicted terrorists, known terrorists, at the border, and they've released them on their own recognizance with a court date 12 years from now to come into court. Who would ever release a terrorist into the United States knowingly?
Well,
only the Biden administration.
I would say, after spending a month in the halls of justice in your fine capital city, I can well imagine a judge's ruling. Okay, so this guy's on the, he's on the no-fly list. Doesn't say anything about taking a flat-bottom skiff across the Rio Grande. That's an entirely different matter. I mean, I could well see several judges I've appeared before going along with that. We've got a question here.
All right. Hi, Mark. Brian O'Quinn from Maryland. So you asked who's lining up to staff the next conservative administration. And I know we like to, you know, make fun of Send Money Now to sendmoneynow.com, but I work for Heritage, and the Heritage Foundation is spearheading the effort to staff that next conservative administration with Project 2025. We've got 2,000 people who have, put into this database. So that's just sort of the answer to your question. If you could answer a question I have, is I like to consume a lot of, media through my smart TV. So like Rumble or Daily Wire, that sort of thing. And I think a lot of people in the audience do that too, or perhaps elsewhere in America. Yeah. I was wondering if you'd consider, publishing on Rumble, or perhaps now that Elon owns X, publishing there just to increase the distribution of your videos?
Why aren't you on Rumble? Why aren't you on Rumble? Why aren't you on Rumble? And I happened to be in France recuperating from my heart attack at that time. So I thought, people keep going on to me about this Rumble thing. I should have a look at it. So I went to rumble.com, and there was a message saying, sorry, Rumble is not available in France because the French government has banned it because it allows allows Russian state propaganda or whatever. So the French state bans Rumble because it's too friendly to the Russian state or whatever it was. And I made a joke when all this stuff started 6-7 years ago that we're going to come down to the last photocopier in the woods, and I'll be printing 20 copies off there, and they're going to be distributed. I'm very cautious. I don't really like platforms. After Parler, everybody said, why aren't you on Parler, Stein? You're a big sissy. Why aren't you going on Parler and being on Parler? 2 days later, I forget whether it was Google or Apple, pulls the plug on Parler. They waited until every big rock-ribbed conservative had exited Twitter and moved to Parler, and then they pulled the plug on it. You know, my late friend Kathy Shadle said 15 years ago that instead of Send Money Now to sendmoneynow.com, or instead of creating news websites like EaglePatriotMinuteman.com or whatever it is, that we should have created these platforms and invested, or the $1 billion that Mitt Romney basically burned.
When $1 billion was real money.
Yeah, back when $1 billion was real money, he might as well have thrown it into the Potomac and taken a photograph as it floated out to sea. If that had been invested in a platform then, I mean, the infrastructure at the moment is so tilted towards the left. And I take your point, but I get that from people saying, well, you know, I had some guy saying, I don't do websites. He said, I like platforms, I don't do websites. I don't think the revolutionary war in the United States, which Michelle and I were on different sides of, but I don't think your...
Not really in the end.
I don't think your revolution would have succeeded if it had only been backed by people who only want to make one click in the morning. You know, I don't think you're not really in the revolutionary spirit if you're not willing occasionally to make two clicks. I don't think, you know, Paul Revere didn't just, you know, post it on Instagram that, you know, the
British are coming.
Yeah,
British.
Oh, wait a minute. I don't want to have to make two clicks. They'll figure it out for themselves. Let's have this lady here.
Thank you. Good afternoon. And Mrs. Bachman, you were my top choice in that cycle. I wanted to say that the top election may be predetermined, but all the down ballot races are still vital and crucial, and self-government starts at home. So your school board, your dog catcher, your state legislature, vitally important. Please study and vote accordingly. Thank you.
That's actually true. What was interesting about a lot of those Joe Biden ballots in swing states is that everyone had voted for Joe Biden, and they hadn't filled out senator,
every
congressman, dog
one.
Catcher. Yeah.
Every ballot was just Joe Biden. Yeah. They could care less about anybody else.
Well, it's also you don't have time. They think, oh, well, wait a minute. It's 10 o'clock at night. We're going to shut the polling booths. We're going to deliver the new ballots at 3 in the morning. Can you just fill them out? You haven't got time to do senator, congressman, dog catcher. You've just got to check the box for president. And go. But eventually, they're going to figure the other offices out too, aren't they?
No, and it depends on the Secretary of State of that state. And so if you're doing mail-in ballots, then you've got time because you can actually do some pre-printed things. There's a lot of dirty tricks and shenanigans that were never available before to us with these kind of remote on-location ballot boxes that show up at any different time with all of these so-called mail-in ballots. Yes. So it can all be pre-done now.
Yeah, that's wonder, the joys of technology. I think we have one last question here.
So you raised a lot of, you know, very provocative and terrifying points, and particularly with regard to the election. And I think everybody in this room sort of assumes that Biden will not be the nominee, or an interesting question is it more, is it better to have a nominee who has alleged clinical dementia and somebody with alleged expressive aphasia versus not? And if that's not going to be the person, who would be the person? And would it be interesting, as you're speaking, Nikki Haley as a Democratic nominee? I mean, these are all kind of things. And one of the comment that I would make is the whole COVID thing sort of self-selected out people in positions of power who were people who thought independently. So our military was decimated because people who refused to get the shot took themselves out of running. And people who were independent thinkers, by virtue of not getting the COVID shot, took themselves out. So what are your thoughts on the nominee who might be interesting nominations for the Democratic Party? Or would it be a person with alleged dementia or aphasia?
Well, Michelle may have a different view on this, but to be just as an observer of American politics, and going back to that point Mike Murphy made to me about how Trump, was, even if he won New Hampshire, was screwed because Mike had spent all the money on Jeb Bush's terrific campaign. And it seems to me that the professional end of American politics, the candidate is the problem. Trump was the lightest entouraged candidate I ever saw. I went backstage to see him a few weeks before the New Hampshire primary, and he had three people with him. He had Hope Hicks, he had Corey Lewandowski, and he had a guy who'd gotten to the quarterfinals of The Apprentice in 2004. And there were candidates who were at like 2% in the polls who had 50 people around them. So the thing that Trump had going for him was he was all candidate and no minders, and people absolutely loved it. And so to beat him, they came up with Joe Biden, who's all minders and no candidate. Nobody actually knows who's in charge of the executive branch of the United States right now. We know that Joe Biden, you know, the guy who can't recognize Abe Lincoln and who thinks that Xi Jinping is the leader of Russia and all this, we know it's not Joe Biden. Which of the other 349 million Americans it is, we don't know. But I think if you talk to political staffers, and there's a few of them on this cruise, if they're honest, they'll admit to you that, you know, the candidate is the problem. Because if you have a clever candidate like Michelle, or I mean, I've known that in some of the Senate candidates in New Hampshire, if you've got a smart, savvy, up-to-the-minute candidate, he's the last thing the staffers want because he's always got his own ideas on things. Someone like Joe Biden, in a certain sense, is the logical endpoint of self-government. Because he's this you put in there, he squints into the prompter, but there's a three-syllable word in there that he can't quite get to. And it doesn't matter. You can run him for 1, 2, 3, 7 terms, and the one thing you can say is he's not gonna get any better. And they're teaching the people a lesson that if you go for someone who's beyond the bounds of what the political establishment deem acceptable, just to rub it into you how wrong you were to have anything to do with them, they're going to run a corpse against that guy, and the corpse is, they're going to sit the corpse behind the Oval Office desk, and everyone's going to go along with the pretense. That's the way I see it, Michelle.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think it's true. I think we all recognize with maybe an 80% chance of certainty that he likely won't be the nominee because he may not be able to get to even November. Mm. I mean, that's a distinct possibility that he doesn't get to November. They've got their plan B, plan C, and plan D in the wings. Mm. And it'll also be somebody who is controllable, whether it's Michelle Obama or whether it's Newsom from California or, who
but
knows.
But it can't not be. They can't, if say, Joe Biden, there's a health emergency, and they can't then say to Kamala, no, we're kicking you off, and we're going to get, they won't do that.
The worst thing that could probably happen to them at this point is if for some reason he had, and I wouldn't wish this on him, a stroke, or he had some debilitating event happen, or end of life. That, I think, would be the worst thing that could happen to the Democrats right now, because in a heartbeat, Kamala Harris is president of the United States, and how do you throw her off? They'd have to get her in a back room and say, it's not you, honey. And then she'd have to make some sort of announcement, out of respect, I am going to serve out until the election, and then I will not be running. So that'd be a lot more than $20 million they'd have to give her to do that. So I don't know what's going on, but I don't foresee they would ever allow her to be on the ticket because, you know, they can make whatever magic and whatever outcome, but nobody would believe that. So I just don't think they're going to do that. They're smarter than that.
Well, she's half Joe's age, and she's got even fewer marbles. Like when she was... staggering around Europe, shoring up the alliance for Ukraine, and she made the error that Ukraine is in NATO, which it isn't, and that's actually quite a big thing. And so she says the first time, Ukraine's as our fellow NATO member or whatever, and you think, okay, they take her aside and say, no, Ukraine actually isn't in NATO. It used to be part of this thing called the Soviet Union, and it's like blah, blah, blah. She then staggers on to some other capital city and says Ukraine's in NATO again, and then she says it a third. And then she does, as you know, all the this fantastic, profound moments that she does where she goes, the passage of time. Do you ever think about that? Time passes. And we live in the moment of the passage of time, even as the time passes to another moment.
I think that's a direct quote.
And you assume that she's doing that because then when Joe Biden goes... people think he's brilliant compared to her. But surely they would have to remove, for the Democrats, to remove a black woman from the position of heir presumptive, they would have to say, we're going to make you Chief Justice or something, wouldn't they?
Well, I think the obvious is that they would have to replace a black woman with a black woman.
Oh.
And so that, to me, then points toward Michelle Obama. I honestly don't think she has any interest in doing it. They're living the lifestyles of the rich and famous. Yeah. They're living the billionaire lifestyle. Yeah. And that's a pretty good gig if you can get it. And I think she loves it. But they need someone. Yeah. And Joe Biden actually doesn't have to put in 40 hours a week. You know, he takes his punch card, he punches it, he does his, his public event, and he goes home. And so I think you're looking, if it is Michelle Obama, if that's who it is, you'll see a campaign that's another book tour. Because probably her next bestseller has already been written by someone. And so then they'll have, it won't be a campaign event, so they'll go to arenas and it'll be Oprah and Beyonce and it'll be all the people up there. And it'll just be basically a book tour, 12 city stop maybe at that. And that'll be it. That's the election. And I think I could see an outcome like that. It won't be real. That much I know. It won't be real.
Well, there are a few nightmare scenarios.
Could I say one thing before we go? This is one of my most precious possessions, and this is my notebook that I had when I had the privilege of being in Washington, D.C. to be there for your trial. And I only knew that I wanted to be there for your trial. There's a line in the Proverbs that says, a friend sticks closer than a brother. And I think, as I observe Mark Stein, you, I see you as being a friend who sticks closer than a brother to all of us. It's you. And you have done this for Western civilization and for the foundational principles. No one has given more or poured out more to hold on to the biggest of values that all of humanity lives on, that rock. And you've been willing to give it all and sacrifice it all. And you have been the friend who has stuck closer than a brother to stand for free speech, to stand for the rule of law. And you've done it. You've left everything on the field, and you continue to leave everything on the field. And so I can say for anyone who came, Stephen McDonald, who's here, a lawyer from Manhattan came down. We had John and Lori Hinderacher from Minnesota. And all I knew is that I was going to be there. I was going to be in that courtroom. And I'm so grateful that for those 2 weeks I could be there. And so I wrote down, I scribbled every note down, because my background is that I'm a federal tax litigation attorney. That's what I did. I practice in U.S. federal tax court, where there are no juries.
Yep.
It's only bench trials to a tax judge who's competent in tax law. And so I was straining to hear, has the prosecutor or has the plaintiff, have they proved the elements of their defamation case? And every day I wrote down, there was never a scintilla of evidence of anything that could even come close to proving the elements of a defamation case. Then I was waiting for damages. Where are the damages? There wasn't a cent of damages that were ever put on the table that could be proven. As you gave in your incredible close, which again you can find on Ann and Phelan's beautiful podcast, you said there was no case to answer, or answer, as you would say. There was no case to answer. Because
I do my Kamala Harris impression, and Michelle's
and
doing
Mark
me
Stein.
Now.
I do my because there was never a case to answer, either for defamation or for damages. And as much as Donald Trump was falsely framed and falsely accused, Mark Stein wasn't there for any personal vainglory moment. He was there because he did what a friend who sticks closer than a brother would do. He took it for us. He took it for every one of us. And the least that we can do is understand what he has done and hope to continue to contend in the way that there's no one like you in the world who has contended for what matters more than anyone else. So I want to thank you, Mark, for what you have done for us. You are a friend who sticks closer than a brother. I say that from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you. That's too kind of you, Michelle. You know, the only story that really matters.
That wasn't charity, my dear. That was the truth.
No, you're very kind. I only do it because, you know, right now the entirety of Western civilization is sliding off a cliff. That's really the only story of our time that matters, and everything else is just a little detail of that story. And so you don't choose these battles. They find you, and you have no choice but to fight them. But I will say that during that miserable, I have no idea how Michelle stuck it in Congress for all those years, because I found it quite the most dispiriting city to be walled up in for a month.
But it was a thimble full of glamour and an ocean full of misery. I can tell you, that's the experience.
I never got to see the thimble full of glamour. I just got the ocean full of misery. But I will say this, that it was brighter. It was brighter, and it was more heartening to have Michelle there by my side. So I thank her for that. I can never thank her enough for that. It was just wonderful to see her every morning and to be in court with Michelle. So thank you, and I look forward to the day. I don't know whether it's this November or a few Novembers down the road when the United States has an entirely normal, clean, fair election again. And may that day come soon. Thank you very much, Michelle Buckman. Thank you.
Join us next time for another edition of The Mark Stein Show. The Mark Stein Show is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.